It is with great honor that I introduce you today to our speaker, Doug Anderson. Doug discovered his love for musical theater at an early age when he would sneak into his older sister's bedroom, now he had three of them, to listen to their musical comedy albums. This set the stage, so to speak, for a very successful life pursuing his theatrical dreams as a playwright, director, musician, singer, actor, and college professor. Doug has always been a strong advocate in the belief that you can't wait for the work to come to you. You must invent the opportunities for yourself. Following this mantra through high school, college, and his adult life has garnered him high honors and praise for his original plays and musicals. His writing, teaching, and performing has moved him across the country from New York City to Nebraska and many places in between. While performing in a nightclub act in Cleveland, Doug met his future wife, Debbie, and they settled in Middlebury, Vermont. While in Vermont, a friend introduced Doug to the Knights of Columbus building and convinced him to turn it into a theater. The structure was built in 1883 and in desperate need of an overhaul. Doug took the long view and decided to pursue a lifelong dream. After reaching out to donors and his beloved community, Doug was able to raise the $5 million to renovate the building, literally brick by brick, and that's a whole nother story, and turn it into a theater and performance space that produces 165 events a year. In 2023, after raising another $8.5 million, they were able to break ground for a 9,000 square foot expansion in an effort to create more rehearsal space, an outdoor performance venue, and practice studios, one of which is now called the Doug and Debbie Anderson Studio. Having served as the executive director during the 28-year renovation, Doug is now the artistic director of the Middlebury Town Hall Theater. Oh, and by the way, he also runs an opera company. He works with young and old alike and just concluded a production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat with teenagers. Although Doug describes himself as a rather chill, laid-back kind of guy, yeah, really, Doug? With his energy, perseverance, and creative genius, this man has embraced his small community and gifted them with a place that will inspire the next generation of dreamers. Please welcome Doug Anderson.
Thank you. Thank you. It's delightful to be here today, but it also terrifies me. Principally because when I teach this at colleges and universities, the history of the American musical, I sometimes have 13 weeks with a couple sessions a week. Even when I'm online, I have many sessions. They tell me I have 40 minutes. I tell a joke at a dinner party, it takes 40 minutes. And I have to put together some sort of coherent narrative today. I'm going to do my best, but buckle your seatbelts. I'm going to go fast. There's a lot of material I want to cover. And I've chosen as my theme today, musicals that matter, something that I care deeply about. And it's fighting a preconception. And that conception is that musicals are fluff. Musicals are escapist. Musicals are silly little things where people, they're a lot of fun. Somebody once said that the musical is for the tired businessman. He wants to see some girls in tights, hear a few jokes, hear a few tunes, and then go home and forget about it. But if you look at the history of the American musical, it has a real strong legacy of social consciousness and a real strong history of engaging what the nation was worrying about and fighting about, dealing with inequality and a whole host of issues, often in incredibly courageous ways. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. I was going to talk about race, then politics, and then gay rights. I'm going to pretty much just be limited to race today, but we'll touch on the others as we can, before they get the hook and pull me off. We'll try to do that. And if we're going to talk about the musicals and race, we have to start in a pretty horrible place and a pretty racist place, because the American musical begins in a racist place. It begins in 1840 with something called the Minstrel Show. And it's generally accepted among experts that the minstrel show is the beginning of the American musical because it is the first stage entertainment in this country where original songs were written for that event. Prior to that, we had what was called a ballad opera where you borrowed tunes from Europe and you wrote your own lyrics to them and then you had a show. But for the first time, we had American songwriters like Stephen Foster and Dan Evan, and they were writing songs for the American musical theater. Now, the minstrel show is something so bizarre you could hardly invent it if you tried. It is white people acting like black people to entertain white people. And it's 1840, so it's white people acting like slaves to entertain black people. I mean, white people. And of course, the way they did it, first slide, please. And you will see the way they did it was something called blackface. Is that what we're seeing right now? Great. Blackface, where a white performer would take a champagne cork, light the end of it, it turns black, wipe it on their face, that's called corking up, and perform like a black person for an American audience. Why would anyone want to, why would the privileged class want to act like the slave class? And how would that be entertaining? Well, part of it is just human nature. We love to denigrate people below us on the social scale, do we not? What's a Polish joke, after all, making fun of somebody below us? But there's a deeper reason, and not just making fun. We have the, I use this term lightly, the advantage in America of two cultures rammed together against their will, really. White American culture, black African culture, come together. When two cultures come together, they learn from each other. They borrow from each other. They adopt things from each other. And Americans looked at black life, black experience, which was right outside the window. And they heard and saw things they couldn't quite believe. One was African music, which had a completely different harmonic scale, flatted thirds, flatted sevenths, what we might now call the jazz scale. They hear it, and it blows their mind. They'd never heard music like that. They hear the call and response. They're hearing music coming from the fields, coming from what was called the praise halls, which was the first black churches. And it also, this music has this propulsive rhythmic energy that they, you know, we were kind of very straight-laced in those days. And suddenly, I mean, who doesn't want to sing doo-dah when I go, Camptown lady, sing this song, doo-dah, doo-dah, Camptown racetrack 5 miles long, oh, doo-dah day. That's exciting. That's Stephen Foster borrowing from black culture. But it was rhythmic, it was fun, it made you want to dance. It was unlike anything we'd ever heard before. Oh, and that's the other thing they saw in black culture. They moved their bodies. They would come after 16 hours in the field, sit around the campfire, cook, make this amazing music, and they would dance. Did we dance in 1840? Your minister would not let you dance in 1840. It was demonic to move your body in a sexy way. And if you're a woman, you were wearing 35 pounds of clothing. Go look at what 1840s women looked like in those days. They were wearing this circle of protection. You couldn't tell what her body looked like. Men were laced up as well. But because it was the South and it was hot, these women around the campfire were wearing just light cotton clothing. You could see the shape of their bodies. It was, let me use the word, sexy. It was exciting. When white people see something they like, they take it. We have to find a way to do this, but we cannot invite black performers into our theaters. If we did, they would burn the theater down. In fact, blacks weren't even allowed to come in as audience members at that time. Hence, the invention of blackface. Now, white people can act like black people, and then sing that kind of music, do that kind of dancing, and the minstrel show is born. And I like to say the minstrel show took hold of this nation like the Beatles did in 1962. It was brand new, it was thrillingly new, and everybody loved it. And because these companies toured up and down the, toured up and down the Eastern Seacoast, this became our first national art form. Everybody heard the songs of Stephen Foster. Everybody saw these, and they would have dances like the Hoochie Coo and the Walkabout and the Cakewalk, and they saw people moving their bodies and having a heck of a good time. I don't think there was a parlor in America in about 1850, 1860 that didn't have a copy of Old Dan Tucker right there in the piano, on the piano. Because not only did they tour, the Beatles sold 45 records, they sold sheet music. So we have the Virginia minstrels and all sorts of other minstrels, the Christie minstrels. So the really pernicious part of all of that, even though if we had more time, we would read some of the lyrics of these songs, which are incredibly offensive, incredibly denigrating to black people in their lives. We're not gonna do that today. But an equally pernicious part of it was the creation of, let's see the next slide, please, of stereotypes that had absolutely nothing to do with black experience. but they worked in the context of the minstrel show. So you have Jim Crow. This is where we get the name Jim Crow. Completely lazy, shiftless, doesn't do an ounce of work. And also funny because he's not very smart. We have Tambo, happy-go-lucky musician, and we have Zip Coon. Look at what Zip Coon is wearing. He's a slave wearing a tailcoat and a top hat. He is happy-go-lucky and loves his life, and he walks around like this all the time. This has nothing to do with black experience. This is a white invention. But this notion of Zip Coon and the happy-go-lucky black, his life completely sanitized for a white audience. I might make a pun and say whitewashed. It's one of the reasons to this day why we can't think straight about race in this country, because this was the view of black life that so many people had. And it stayed around for 120 years. We can see the next slide. When we get to vaudeville in the 1910s, 1920s, the biggest star is Al Jolson. Does that name mean anything to you? He blacked up, and he came out and went, "Mammy, mammy, the sun shines east," and he killed him. He dominated Broadway theater for many years. Eddie Cantor wore blackface. So many characters wore blackface. And when MGM starts making musicals in the 1930s, we can have the next slide. This is Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland in a big musical playing across the nation to big crowds in blackface. Again, with this stereotypical view of what black life is, it's just all completely happy, completely wonderful. I have to get in the fact that in my own state of Vermont, University of Vermont, until the late 1960s, had the cakewalk. The fraternity men would all black up and entertain not only the college, but the entire state. And when it was finally canceled in 1967, in Vermont, there was a hue and cry. This was unjust. These were good boys doing good work, and we shouldn't take this away from them. The primary writer was a man named Stephen Foster, whom you know thought to be the father of the American song. What Stephen Foster did is he heard black melodies, and he wrote new lyrics and sold them to white audiences. So, "Roll Jordan, roll," black spiritual, "Roll Jordan, roll," becomes "Gonna run all night, gonna run all day," Camptown Races. He published hundreds and hundreds of songs. He was probably the number one writer of minstrel show songs. And there was a statue of him in Pittsburgh, next slide please, which is a picture of Stephen Foster with Old Black Joe. That was one of his most famous songs. There's a lyric in Old Black Joe, who is dying in the song, "Gone are the days when my heart was young and gay. Gone are my friends from the cotton fields far away." That's not what life was like in the cotton fields. Nothing to do with life in the cotton fields. But this was an enormously popular song. But what's funny about this statue, funny and weird and scary, that's Stephen Foster sitting over Old Black Joe. He's got a pen and pencil. Can you see that? He's taking down the music so that he can then repackage it and sell it. Finally, about 10 years ago, Pittsburgh said, "This is not in good taste," and that statue has since been removed. So we have this history of not thinking straight about race in the American musical, and of course in the American culture for some time. But that all changes in 1927 with a musical that really changes everything, and it's called Showboat. And it's written by Oscar Hammerstein and with Jerome Kern. I think that's the next slide. Jerome Kern, the brilliant composer. Hammerstein brought a social consciousness to the American musical in very powerful ways, and ways that I think that are still with us. And he said, "Okay, I'm going to take Edna Ferber's novel, Showboat, and I'm going to turn it into a musical." And everybody says, "No, you're not. No, you are not. Musicals are fun. That's very serious. No, I'm going to do it." Jerome Kern agrees with him. They find, as a producer, of all people, Florence Ziegfeld, who did the Ziegfeld Follies, who was also quite progressive. And they put up this musical that they think it's gonna be a huge flop. Ziegfeld said, "I'm gonna support this, but it's not gonna go." Do you know what the plot is about? Miscegenation, mixed race marriages. Julie is a great performer on the Showboat, but she has a secret. She has a black mother. And that which is hinted at subtly in the early part of the musical. And then her husband is a great performer as well. He's trying so hard to keep this secret because they would be arrested and thrown in jail. And just sidebar about miscegenation and mixed race marriages. That sounds so horrible. And the musical is set somewhere in the late 1800s. In 1967, 16 of our states had miscegenation laws. Mixed-race marriages were illegal that late. In the year 2000, Alabama still had a law against mixed marriages. This is the country we live in. But Hammerstein was going to fight it. So he writes this miscegenation story based on Edna Ferber. The scene in which they are arrested, when I was looking at it again, resonates very strongly to me, because it's like an ICE raid, I tell you. There's no music in this scene at all. It goes on for a long time, and a guy comes in, presents them with this evidence, and takes them off of the boat. They cannot perform anymore. It's a very sad story. I mean, it's an incredibly sad story. Now, the story of her daughter is a slightly different story, but it would have seemed absolutely amazing and shocking in those days. It was successful for a number of reasons. I think the next slide is a Ziegfeld production of it. It was one of the biggest things Broadway had ever seen. It had a huge cast. Not only was the storyline sort of very, very brave, avant-garde, challenging, there was a character in it named Joe, written for Paul Robeson. He couldn't play the original, but he eventually plays it in the 1936, I think, film, which I would really recommend. And Joe is just a man. He's not a stereotype. Well, some of the scenes, there's some old minstrelsy still in there. And some people don't like Showboat because there's still some old sort of racist-tinged racism in there. That's they're coming out of that tradition. But Joe was allowed to sit on stage and just be a guy. Just be a man who's miserable. He's not a slave, but it's late 1880s, so he's still living a slave's life. He is unloading ships for 16 hours a day. He's breaking his back, and he realized he has no future in this country. The song, of course, is what? Old Man River. River being time. River being the thing that's going to sweep him to his death with nothing accomplished, with a broken body, with no money. The lyric, I'm tired of living and scared of dying. And Jerome Kern gives him this amazingly heroic and humanizing tune in which to sing. And that was a groundbreaking moment in the American theater. It always strikes me that I'll come across an old Frank Sinatra album and he's singing Old Man River. I'm like, you didn't earn that quite. But the fact that we finally have something close to real Black experience on the American stage, and that is from Oscar Hammerstein. I want to stay with him for just a minute. All of his career, and you know him, of course, from Rodgers and Hammerstein, you know, Oklahoma all the way to The Sound of Music. But prior to that, all of his musicals, in some sense, had this wonderful humanistic quality. And probably the most important one of these in our context today is something called South Pacific in 1949, based on the James A. Michener book. I'm going to turn that into a musical. No, you're not. You cannot do that, Mr. Hammerstein. Oh, yes, I can. What's it about but two relationships which are destroyed by racism, overtly named racism? You've got Nellie Forbush, played by Mary Martin, and Emile Debeck, played by the opera singer Ezio Pinza. They've fallen in love. Do I have the record? Is the record cover up? It's up there. You're way ahead of me. I love that. They fall in love. She's in love with him. What? I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love, I'm in love. She says it a lot. With a wonderful guy. And that's Oscar Hammerstein writing that lyric. And she knows she has two kids. But the devastating scene is when she meets those kids and they're children of color. He was married to a woman from the South Seas. And suddenly she can't marry him. I can't take, excuse the word, colored children back to Kansas. I cannot do it. I'm sorry, I was born this way. I cannot do it. And that relationship breaks up. It manages to come together just barely at the end of the musical. But it is shocking for her to talk that way. And we've fallen in love with this character, and then we see this inbred racism. Not only that, there's a second plot, Lieutenant Cable, who falls in love with a Tonkinese girl named Liat. Again, she's a woman of color, and he desperately wants to make this work, but because of the racism of everybody around them, it does not work. This is incredible things to start talking about in 1949, and Hammerstein insists on doing it. Not only that, he writes a song, as if you didn't get it, I'm going to write a song specifically about this. And I don't know if you remember this song, it's called Carefully Taught. You have to be carefully taught. Nellie says, You can't blame me for my racism. I was born this way. And he says, no, you weren't. You were taught to think this way. And so he writes this very powerful song, which created a hullabaloo throughout the nation, that the Broadway theater, which is supposed to be fluff and inconsequential and just fun, would say something this serious that was, and then he kept, and they said, you gotta cut this song. He said, we're not cutting the song. In the film, they said, well, this can't play in the South. We're not cutting the song. We'll see how the South responds to it. But this is carefully taught. Oh, and it's nice because this was made for one of those little videos that, videos, they weren't videos, films they showed before films back then, like News of the Day. And so we get to see Oscar Hammerstein introduce the singer who sang it on Broadway.
In the second act of South Pacific, a young American Navy nurse explaining her race prejudice says, I can't help this. This is emotional. It's born in me. And the second character, the man who is losing her because of this prejudice, shouts his protest. I do not believe this. I do not believe these things are born in you. And a third character, a young Marine lieutenant, played by my friend here, Bill Tabbert, says,
it's not born in you. It happens after you're born. You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made, and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are six or seven or eight, to hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be carefully taught.
That song would be alarming in certain circles today. Today. Well, the South went nuts. Legislatures went nuts, tried to ban the film, tried to ban this song from the film. Leaders in Georgia, because of this, introduced a law outlawing entertainments containing, quote, an underlying philosophy inspired by Moscow. This was during McCarthyism, of course. And you could use that term, communism, to battle anything you wanted to battle. Plus ça change. Another legislature said the song about interracial marriage was implicitly a threat to the American way of life. When it went on tour in Georgia in the 1950s, a state rep said, I'm going to name names, David C. Jones, where are you now? We in the South are proud and progressive people. Half-breeds cannot be proud. And Hammerstein takes this musical on tour in the South and managed to get away with it. It's also, I think, it's a pretty interesting film. It's a little dated in places, but this is Oscar Hammerstein. Larry Maslin, who's one of my favorite Broadway historians, had this to say about the extraordinary Oscar Hammerstein. He says, I always thought of Oscar Hammerstein as a preacher in a way I think of Abraham Lincoln as a preacher. Lincoln used the White House. Oscar used the theater. All of his shows offer a kind of benign choice, that tolerance is probably better than prejudice, that enlightenment is probably better than ignorance. And I think he appealed in the way that Lincoln did in his second inaugural address to the better angels of our nature. That was Oscar Hammerstein. I want to give you one other example of this. One of the ways that the theater sort of tried to deal somehow with the inequality that we have in this. It was actually casting black performers before it was thought you could do so. Florence Ziegfeld himself, who produced Showboat, did a series of the Ziegfeld Follies. Does that mean anything? Great extravaganzas, lots of singing, Helen Morgan, all of these people doing it. But he, Burt Williams was a black comic, and Ziegfeld saw his amazing talent and said, I'm gonna headline you in the, I think it was the Follies of 1917. When it was announced, the entire cast went on stage and said, we will not perform tonight because we will not perform with be on stage with a black performer. And Ziegfeld said, I can replace any one of you. I cannot replace Burt Williams. Burt Williams went on. For 3 years in a row, he was a major headline in Broadway. In 1917, 1890, this is early to have a black performer on stage. Paul Robeson, Lena Horne, the musical was always pushing forward as much as it could, black performers. And one of the best is Ethel Waters. Does that name mean anything to you? It amazes to me how people from several decades ago can be household words, and then if they didn't make movies, they disappear. And Ethel Waters, during the early 1930s, was the highest paid performer on Broadway, and it was a black woman. She had an amazing voice, amazing soulful quality. And in 1933, there was a review called As Thousands Cheer. Am I getting ahead of myself here? No, I... Okay. We'll talk about Ethel Waters in a minute. I'm prisoner to the PowerPoint here today. I want to talk a little bit about politics in the 1930s. 1930s depression, right? Everything is politicized, and everybody's upset. What is the system that could cause this to happen? Do we have a slide of... do we have a slide of breadline? Slide of the breadline. Who caused this? People with money, Wall Street, people trying to manipulate things, people getting rich on the back of everyone else. So it's a terrible, terrible time. Broadway responds with incredibly political work. There was a headline at the time that said, the Great White Way turns a little red, because it was doing progressive things. And I want to tell you about one show called Cradle Will Rock in 1937. It was written, it was directed by Orson Welles, written by Mark Blitstein. And it was a very strong Brechtian kind of piece. And the plot of this was one man owned an entire town, Mr. Mister. And he not only owned the town, he owned all the stores, and he owned all the people in it. And the kind of brilliance of this piece is that there are prostitutes in this town, he owns them, but he makes it, the musical makes a nice connection that people who are working in his mills are prostitutes as well, giving their bodies to make somebody else rich. Wonderful piece, interesting piece. So this is what happens. Opening night, the director is Orson Welles. Remember, a young Orson Welles. Before he was Orson Welles, he was doing this. And they get to the theater, the Maxine Elliott Theater, and the crowd arrives, and the theater is padlocked. The US government found out about this piece and padlocked the theater. That's how incendiary a Broadway musical could be. Orson Welles is not going to sit for it. He makes a few phone calls, finds an empty theater 20 blocks north, the Venice Theater. The actors lock arms, the audience gets behind him, and they march up 8th Avenue in defiance of the U.S. This is an American musical, guys. March up at the Avenue. They get to this theater to get there. But the time they get to that theater, the government has gotten to the Actors' Equity Union. And the government has told Actors' Equity, you're going to have to kick anybody who performs on that stage tonight. You've got to kick them out of the union. And it's the Depression, which means they'd starve to death. So it was decided that Mark Blitstein, who couldn't sing and had stage fright, would sit on stage with an out-of-tune piano and play through the whole thing, and sing through the whole thing, playing all the roles. We're going to do it. So the place is packed, absolutely packed. And the actors are in the audience. And he starts to play the opening number, and when the first prostitute is supposed to sing, the diminutive actor Olive Stanton in the 8th row stands up and starts singing. And the woman who had the second line up in that box started singing. And suddenly the whole cast got in. They improvised the entire show in the audience because they were told if you performed on that stage, you get fired. And they had figured this out. And they are doing chase scenes through the seats, and they are doing dance numbers in the aisles, and it's absolute mayhem. The show, of course, is an enormous hit. and has a good, good long run. There is a film by Tim Robbins, the actor Tim Robbins, married to Susan Sarandon, I believe. He made a film of this called Cradle Will Rock. It's probably on Netflix, and it tells the story of that night and defying the U.S. government because what you were doing bothered it. There are a lot of, I can talk about all kinds of things. I love, there was a show about unions, which was made up of amateur seamstresses from the garment district. It was called Pins and Needles. And they would literally work all day and then walk up to a Broadway theater right on the stage and perform. And it was, of course, it was very political because there was union members were being shot and killed in the late 1930s, and they were brave enough to stand up there and do their message. Now, there was a review. That's also at the beginning of the Depression. A Broadway musical gave us the song that became the anthem of the Depression, called "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime," which everybody was singing, and it's about the forgotten veterans. The government is now going to take away their pensions. So they march on Washington, and Washington calls out the army to fire on them, veterans, and disperse them. And that's where we get the song, "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime," which everybody was singing by the end of the Depression. There was a review called A Thousand's Cheer. It was neat because it was set up like a living newspaper. So there would be the fashion section, and there'd be a musical number about the fashion section. The weather column in the paper gives us the song, "We're having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave," songs you know. And it kept changing as the news changed. I think the closest thing we have today is Saturday Night Live, which is always trying to keep up with what's happening. This show did as well. But in one amazing moment, Ethel Waters comes out. At that time, she was famous. And she sings a song about a lynching. And the writer here is the man who is the father of American music, Irving Berlin. And it's a song not so much about the lynching, but the woman, the wife, who comes home afterwards and realizes she has to feed her family. She has to feed her supper. How am I going to get through supper with my kids? How am I going to get through the rest of my life? It's called Supper Time. And fortunately, this was caught on television in the early 1950s. So this is Ethel Waters singing Supper Time from a Broadway musical.
The brick wall on the back of the theater was the first set. The entrance of Ethel Waters, this monumental woman, had a bandana on her head. She had an apron on. The curtain closes behind her. Behind her was the silhouette of a man hanging from a tree with his head on the side, with the rope around his neck. We didn't know in those days about lynchings in the South.
It was very unbelievable that they did it in the first place, because you didn't bring in reality into a musical comedy or a review. It was unheard of.
She came forward with the beat of that orchestra, this funk of hers. Oh, and aussprachen, and she went into it, and this woman went,
"Supper! Set the table, 'cause it's supper time. Somehow I ain't able, 'cause that man of mine ain't coming home no more. From telling them that man of mine."
If one song can tell the whole tragic history of a race, Supper Time was that song. In singing it, I was telling my comfortable, well-fed, well-dressed listeners about my people.
Extraordinary. You know, we've established that there's a kind of a real progressive streak in people making musicals in this period. The question is, could you show me that again?
I can't read it. 11?
Oh, it's 11:40. Okay. a real progressive streak. Often way ahead of the curve of conversations other people are having in this country about not only race, but especially race. Why do you think the musical, of all things, had that in its DNA? The answer to that question is, who was making musicals? Do you know? This will sound anti-Semitic. It's not. Jews. The American musical is a Jewish creation. I don't know if you've thought about it, but if you think of all of the major composers, people who made musicals in the first 60 or 70 years, they were Jewish. Irving Berlin, born Israel Balin. Jerome Kern, Richard Rodgers, Harold Arlen, born Hyman Arluck. Kurt Weill, Sheldon Harnick, Jerry Bock, Leonard Bernstein, Stephen Sondheim, Lerner and Lowe, Comden and Green, Kander and Ebb. There's only one significant composer of the period, which is Cole Porter, who was not Jewish. He just happened to be the richest boy in Indiana. And that's a, I'll come back and talk about that if you want. But no, you can't talk about Cole Porter in a church, actually. Why is this important? Between 1880 and 1920 or 30, 2.8 million Jews emigrated to this country. This was the great diaspora. Where are they coming from? They're coming from Ukraine. They're coming from the pogroms. They're coming from violence and terrorism. They're coming from Poland. They're coming from Germany. They could no longer live there because of the terror and the intense anti-Semitism. Irving Berlin, who wrote that song, born in Russia. His only memory of his boyhood in Russia is when the mob came to burn down their family home. They come to America thinking it's going to be different, thinking it has to be different. All men are created equal, right? There's a lady in the harbor saying, come on in, we want you here. They expected it to be different. And they get here, they're kept on the Lower East Side. Many jobs they cannot get. They can entertain, but they can't have other jobs, important jobs in business. No, Jewish people cannot do that. And so these are people who are, they're not going to let it happen here. They're going to fight back. And this is baked into the DNA of the American musical because of the injustice all of these people, and all of these people have stories. They're either first, second, or third generation Jewish immigrants. There's a whole lot to be said about the Jewish influence, about the influence of things like klezmer, about how Jewish services are incredibly musical. Many of these people had fathers who were cantors. They went and saw people sing every Sunday. One of them said, if you grew up the way I did, going to Sabbath, you walk into a theater on Broadway, it's exactly the same place. It's musical, it's tuneful, it moves you, it has a story. Again, another time maybe we can talk about that. The clock is staring me in the face and it's taunting me right now. It is taunting me. To this day, of course, the American musical is really very out front when it comes to issues of race. I don't know if you know musicals like Ragtime, The Color Purple, Caroline or Change, very strong. Hamilton, a little thing called Hamilton. Hairspray, the musical is outspoken. It also was really terrific when it came to gay rights and homophobia. It always surprises me that the first major person to come out, public person to come out in this country was Ellen DeGeneres on her television show. Do you remember that? That was 1997. That was yesterday. Prior to that time, if you were gay, you lived an incredibly closeted existence. So when the musical La Cage aux Folles comes out in 1983, it's about two gay men in a relationship. And George Herm, who I happen to know, I'm so happy I know this man, sang this song that became the anthem of gay rights music, I Am What I Am. Did anybody see that? People were on their feet, weeping. And it was a comedy, it's a wild farce. But he says, I am what I am. Life's not worth a damn until you can say, I am what I am. And that's in 1983, and it's coming from a musical. Now, a musical is like, it's not just a stage in New York. The Broadway musical is a national stage because of all cast albums, because of touring, because companies like the one you've got up here on the hill, what's it called, the Summer Company? I'm hearing such great things about this company. I really am. I have to come back. But in the 90s, a wonderful musical called Falsettos, which dealt unflinchingly with the AIDS crisis. And lately, a musical called Fun Home by Alison Bechdel, which I highly recommend. So the musical still talks out, still speaks out, still tries to stir the pot, agitate. And one other thing I've got time for, thank goodness. Who was around for the 1960s? How long was your hair? It was the counterculture, of course, and it was anti-war, it was anti-racism, it was a bunch of young people trying to fight everything that was wrong with this country. It was also a little wacky, let's face it, and there was sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but there was rock and roll. And it was an extraordinary time, and the anthem for that movement, let's call it the youth movement, or the counterculture, that's what we called it, came from a musical in 1965, I think. It was called Man of La Mancha. Do you know that musical? And there's a song in it. In first place, it's set somewhere in like the 17th century, but it was about the 1960s. Everything on stage on Broadway in the 1960s was about the 1960s. It was about the Vietnam War, was about inequality. And this song, To Dream the Impossible Dream, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. It touched a lot of people. It is said that in one of the marches on Broadway, marches on Washington, D.C., in 1971, there were several marches at the time, but in 1971, tens of thousands of people there at the Lincoln Memorial, it is said, spontaneously broke into To Dream the Impossible Dream. Their people were weak. Now, people say that because I'm not sure it was spontaneous. I'm not sure like somebody like Doug Anderson didn't plan that, knowing that it would be very effective. And at Rosa Parks' funeral, Rosa Parks, a great icon of civil rights movement, at her funeral, Aretha Franklin sang that song, To Dream the American Dream, and it came from an American musical. I hope I've made the point in this very short time I've had that musicals matter, and they continue to matter. And when I teach, I often like to go out on a sing-along. Let's take this music inside of us. Let's see what it means to us. You're going to get the lyrics on the screen to The Impossible Dream. I will play the piano. If it moves you, you stand up and put a fist in the air. I don't care. Get in touch with your younger self, your younger activist self. But we'll sing this. We'll have fun with it, okay?
The microphone. Here we go. To dream the impossible dream. And the world will be better for this.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Fun fact, Doug, we just did that last year at the Peterborough Players with Scott Bakula and his wife, Chelsea. And it was an amazing production. We have some questions, time for a few questions. For those watching virtually, you may continue to submit your questions by using the live chat section on YouTube. While the ushers collect the yellow cards, let me begin by asking you a question, Doug, and this has nothing to do with what you just spoke about. It has more to do with you. How did you manage to get an upright piano into your third floor walk-up dorm room senior year at Kenyon College?
Is this on? Am I good? Yes? No? Good? Yep. Great. First place, I roomed for 3 years with this crazy character at Kenyon College named Rob Eichler, who's here today. And it was a wonderful, wonderful life. But when I was in high school, a group of, can you hear me? When I was in high school, a group of my friends and I, we created a traveling children's theater company in Southern Ohio. And we built a trailer that one wall came down. So we had a stage, so we played at libraries and parks. No adults anywhere. And this would be 67, 68, 69. It was a different world. I would say to my mom, yeah, we're playing Chillicothe and, you know, Columbus today. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. I'll be home a little after midnight. Sure thing, fine, no problem. Could kids do that today? It was a safe world. And we were safe, and we played all over Southern Ohio. Anyway, it was called the Summer Youth Theater Company. It had a long life after me. And so I basically said, well, it was a summer thing. I said, we're not using the piano. And my senior thesis was a musical adaptation of a Molière play, The Doctor in Spite of Himself, which I called Complications, which I thought was very clever. Anyway, so I needed a piano, and so I said, I'm taking the piano, I'm putting it in my dorm room. Rob was there. We were the talk of the campus. You guys have a piano in your dorm room? I'm like, yeah. But I had this group of high school kids I'd worked with to say, I'm taking the piano, and you get to hang out at Kenyon for a while, which is the most beautiful campus in the world, if you've ever seen it. It looks like something out of Hogwarts. And so everybody came up, and we got it up 3 flights of stairs. And I guess at the end of the year, we somehow got it out. But we lived with a piano. Thank you for asking that question. That's a great memory, actually.
Okay, there's a question from the audience. If you were to write a musical right at this moment, what would be your theme?
I'm not sure. Okay. No, really, I mean, whenever you write anything, and I've done a lot of writing in my life, and I've written plays, et cetera, the question is, what do we need to talk about now, today? Yeah, in a way, you know, what sort of things, and what is the story, what is the narrative that's going to sort of bring all of that home? And sometimes, however, I will admit, sometimes you latch onto a story that just has such psychological power and interest that you want to tell that story. Well, I wrote a musical a while back, and it was based on the life of a woman I knew in England who, her husband was in finance or something, and he spent time in the Middle East. She wasn't exactly sure what he did until he disappeared. He we were with her. Debbie and I were with her in her big house, and she had no idea where he was. She showed me the note that the Queen sent her, saying, "I'm so sorry. I hope we find him." And then she gradually came to learn more and more about him and what he was really doing. And I thought that was a lovely metaphor for just the way we deal with other human beings. We have this concept, and then the more you know, the more you learn that people are complex and doing interesting things, sometimes for good reasons, sometimes for not for good reasons. So I wrote a musical, it's just for a few women. I also, all the women are over 50. And I've got a thing about musicals where if you're not 27 and beautiful, you can't be in them. So I wanted to write a musical for all of the actresses I'd worked with in the past, that really good, wonderful stories that they could tell. So that's the idea of it. And we recently did a production at my theater, and we'll see where it goes from here. But it's a good question, though.
Are there any equivalent musicals that expose racism against Native Americans, whether older or contemporary?
I worked on one at the Kennedy Center called 90 North, which is again, I often think, why would anybody ever write fiction? Because there's so many amazing stories in life that there. But this is a story about, it's not Native Americans necessarily, but First Nations people. The Museum of Natural History, Robert Peary, discovering the North Pole, he brought back Inuits to put on display at the Museum of Natural History. And they all died because they didn't have the immune system. But you would go on Sunday and see this family, and they'd be there going like this, living there. And the only one who survived was a young boy named Minnick. But by that point, he was famous. He probably died because he was young and he had good immuno-whatever. And he went into vaudeville as a performer, because that's all he knew, was performing at the Museum of Natural History. But the Museum of Natural History behaved very, very poorly. But at that point, nobody, they were obviously inferior beings, and we could do that to them. And I worked on that with Stephen Schwartz at the Kennedy Center. But I'm trying to think of a mainstream musical that deals with those subjects. And if you write about something, you have to have the authority to write about it. I mean, you have to do the work. You've got to do the homework. But that's a really good question. There certainly nothing on Broadway. I won't go there.
I'll give you a new one. Okay. Can Broadway continue to make social change when it costs so much money to see a show and so many producers are needed to get the show launched?
That was the second 30 minutes of my conversation today. No, honest to God, who wrote? Rob, did you write that? The pressures of Broadway are getting worse and worse and worse. I teach a whole class on just the economics of Broadway, because the dollars are determining what you're seeing on the Broadway stage. Right now, a musical will be capitalized $20 to $40 million to get your musical up. That gets you to opening night. If you are not doing 90% houses right from the start, you close. If you want to lose money, the best investment in the world for losing money is the Broadway musical. 90% of Broadway musicals lose their entire investment. So why would people do it? Well, say you're a dentist in Montclair. Somebody know a dentist in Montclair? Say you got a lot of money. You could put $25,000 into a musical. Say you get to hang out with, pick somebody, some big star. Audra McDonald. You're going to be a producer of a Broadway musical. That's going to sound really good on the golf course. And you get to then go to rehearsals and hang out and be there for opening night. It's thrilling. People have said, you know, I could give $25,000 to my museum and never see it again. I can give $25,000 to a Broadway musical and live this wonderful life for a year. It's developed and being there on opening night in a tuxedo and then going to Sardi's afterwards and waiting for the reviews to come out. And they're terrible and I lost my money. Yay, I had a great time. But that is why, which is why, do you watch the, and if it wins the Tony, you get to go up on stage at the Radio City Music Hall. And have you watched the Tonys? When something wins Best Play, there are 87 people on stage. And you know, people at home are like, who are these people? They're dentists from Montclair. So this is the thing. But because of these economic pressures and because you can't make money, Broadway has gotten incredibly conservative financially. Because you can't, so we start to see really nasty trends, I think, in the American musical. One is called the jukebox musical. Do you know a jukebox musical? You take the music of, do we really need a Neil Diamond musical? But you take the music of Neil Diamond, you wrap a story around it. For $200, people come see a musical and they already know the songs. We have the John Lennon musical. We have the Cher musical running right now. We have the Michael Jackson musical. Oscar Hammerstein is turning over in his grave. There's nothing particularly creative about this from a musical point of view. You're just packaging. And the one that began it all was Mamma Mia and the music of ABBA. And when I got there, by the time we saw it, by the middle of the second act, people are dancing in the aisles. It's not a musical in any sense. And don't ask me to record. They wrapped a plot around it that doesn't even make sense. In fact, I'm doing a love song scene with you, and suddenly you break into The Winner Takes It All. It has nothing to do with what we were talking about. But they wanted to cram that song, and this is the jukebox musical. It's the cheapest thing to produce, and it has a built-in audience. And so most of the audience for Broadway shows are tourists. So you've come from Albuquerque. You want to make sure you see something you love, and the tickets are now $250. Oh, I love Michael Jackson. Let's go see that one. And so that is really driving a lot of what we see. We also see a lot of revivals, but worse still, from my view, is musicals based on movies, specifically Disney movies. Once again, the kid has seen The Lion King. The kid knows every single song in The Lion King, but in Disney's defense, Disney has taken over Broadway. Do you know that? I mean, it's, you know, what, 12, 13, 14 revivals of Disney films. Beauty and the Beast, all of it. In Disney's favor, these productions are gorgeous. They've spent, I was in tears after the opening of Lion King. I just had never seen anything, which was directed by an avant-garde director, incidentally, Julie Taymor. But Disney can go the long haul. I mean, we'll put a lot of money in it. We'll make it back in 5 years. And they have. So we have revivals. We have Disney reboots. It's odd. It's unusual, not completely impossible these days. So what's really happening now is that the interesting work on new musicals is happening in regional theaters. So it's something like La Jolla Playhouse or Goodspeed Opera, where work on it there, get rave reviews. People from New York will come out and see it and say, oh yeah, I will take a chance on that. That is a story worth telling and worth doing. But it's to open a show on Broadway right now is just absolutely, absolutely a crazy thing to do. And then you hear things like, Broadway had a record year. Yeah, because tickets are $250. And they used to be $67, you know? So the economics of Broadway are fucked. I'm not sure what that word means. I'll use that word. That's good.
Thank you, okay? Doug, for this amazing content and wonderful exposure to what you do. So thank you for your expertise as well.
Thanks, everybody. There's a reception. Do you know about the reception?
We hope you've enjoyed today's presentation of the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, and thank you for your support of our 2025 season. Please join us next week to hear Nora Pfeiffer talk about Making Room for the Audience, a conversation with a theater and film director. As part of Nora's presentation, the Lyceum has arranged for a screening of her film, Another Happy Day, at the Peterborough Community Theater on Saturday, August 9th at 11:30 a.m. Viewing the film is not a prerequisite for enjoying Nora's Lyceum talk, but will definitely be engaging and entertaining.